Okay, tonight we'll be dealing with the subject production versus consumption, the macroeconomic implications of scarcity. And my main assignment to myself is to present and develop two radically opposed, mutually exclusive, fundamental views of the central problem of economic life, and show how these different views appear in a wide variety of major matters. And one view I call productionism. According to it, the fundamental problem of economic life is how to increase the production of wealth. How can we expand the production of wealth? And productionism takes for granted the existence of a limitless need and desire for wealth. There's no problem of people needing or desiring wealth. The problem is producing it. In sharpest contrast, the doctrine of consumptionism believes that there is a strictly limited need and desire for wealth, and we already can, or are about, or are soon will be able to produce more than we need or desire. And so, in the view of consumptionism, the fundamental problem is how to expand the need or desire for wealth so that it will be made adequate to our ability to produce it. So you won't be in suspense, I'll tell you right off that I hold the philosophy of productionism. I think it's obvious that we need and desire wealth without any limit. And the problem is how to expand the supply of wealth, how to produce more and more of it. And just as an illustration of the proposition, I think I would expect practically all of you to agree that if someone is aware of the existence of automobiles and doesn't own one, he almost certainly would like to have one. If someone has an automobile, he would almost certainly like to have a newer, better automobile. If he has several of the newest, best quality automobiles, then very likely he'd want something like a yacht or a plane. If he should have a yacht and a plane, then he will become interested in the kind of yacht on which a plane can land. So there is always something further. Now, I think there is an underlying philosophical basis for this. It's not an issue of social and cultural conditioning, or keeping up with the Jones family, or anything of that kind. Our limitless need and desire for wealth can be traced back to our fundamental nature as the rational being. The distinguishing characteristic of human beings is that they possess the faculty of reason, and reason gives us the potential for a limitless range of knowledge and awareness. This is addressed in the very first point, reason and the range of knowledge and awareness. No other species has the kind of range of knowledge and awareness that we do. Your pet, cat, or dog is aware only of what's within his field of sensory perception. So if he can see something, hear it, smell it, anything of that kind, he can be aware of it. But if something is not within his field of sensations or perceptions, he has no awareness. He can't be aware of things that are not perceptually present. Human beings hold knowledge in the form of concepts. We have had sensory perceptions. We've seen things, heard things, touched them, smelled them, whatever. And on that basis, we have formed certain concepts. And we retain the concepts. We're able to retain the concepts, even though the things on the basis of which they've been formed are no longer perceptually present. And the concepts will apply to all other members of that class or category. And this permits us to take a limitless range of action. While our pet, cat, or dog can only act with respect to what he can see or hear or smell, so if he sees a rabbit, he can chase that rabbit. But if the rabbit is no longer around, he can't do anything with respect to the rabbit. But human beings can take action, not just with respect to a rabbit, for which they could easily build a trap when there's no rabbit currently around, but we're routinely taking action with respect to events thousands of miles away and many years in the future. And all you have to do to verify that is think of some of the contracts that the firm you work for may have with foreign suppliers or customers and the range of time that those contracts embrace. And we are able to act, as I say, with respect to events far, far distant in space and far distant in time. And we have awareness, of things from billions of years ago, billions of light years in space. We have an awareness of things from subatomic particles to the entire universe, and we can be aware of all kinds of patterns and differences and similarities and relationships that no other species can be aware of. And this limitless potential for knowledge and also awareness, we're aware of things based on this, our limitless potential for knowledge and awareness underlies the potential, limitless potential for action and experience. The range of action that we can take, the kinds of experiences that we can have, depend on our range of knowledge and awareness. So we routinely experience things very differently than other species. If you're playing your favorite music in the presence of your pet, you hear it in a very different way than he hears it. You can hear rhythms, harmonies, melodies, which the pet can't. You can look at a picture or painting and see it as representing something, and it's not likely that your pet can. Now, if we can hold in mind the proposition that our limitless range of knowledge and awareness gives us the potential for a limitless range of action and experience, the only thing further that we need to realize is that wealth is the material means of action and experience. The different forms of wealth that we employ, and I'm not talking about just dollars, I'm talking about actual physical goods. All of the different types of goods that we employ are vital in enabling us to act in the world and have experiences. So wealth embraces all categories of tools, implements, machines, and to that extent, it's enhancing the power of our arms and legs. Wealth enhances the power of all of our senses. Our eyes are enhanced by eyeglasses, contact lenses, machinery for performing laser surgery, microscopes, telescopes, also television sets, DVDs, VCRs, motion pictures. Our hearing is enhanced not only by hearing aids, but also by radio, CD players, before that, phonographs. The power of our thinking is enhanced by books, calculators, computers, and so everything we do is enhanced by wealth. And then we have many of our experiences are based on wealth. Wealth is not only instrumentalities, it's also objects of contemplation in the form of works of art, sculpture, landscape grounds, beautiful homes, furniture, clothing. These are sources of experience. And so there's no limit to our potential for action and experience. Wealth is the material means of action and experience, and I think it follows that there is no limit to our need for wealth. And that, I think, is the basis of why we desire more wealth. And yes, Mr.
Hoffman?
I'm sorry?
Steve Kaufman.
Hoffman.
Kaufman.
Kaufman, okay.
K-U-F-M.
Right, okay.
You know, American society tends to light consumption today.
Yeah.
Versus tomorrow, let's say.
Yeah.
Do you see that the U.S. may lose the technological advantage in the long run because we tend to spend more today instead of saving?
Okay, you're asking, you're observing that people have a very high premium on current consumption, which implicitly raises the question, what is the status of saving? And then you're asking further, what implication does this have for an economic situation or technological superiority, productive superiority? Okay, saving is not in contradiction of the desire to consume. Funds that are saved are the foundation of being able to provide for consumption in the future. And it's a question of when do you wish to consume, today or in the future. And you might be very, very old, even if you fully accept the idea of your imminent death, if there are other people alive whom you value, like children or grandchildren, their life and happiness is important to you, and so you derive value from their ability to consume. Now, just let me make an observation about why the accumulation of savings is always tied to the potential to consume. Imagine that we had a law which said it's unfair for some people to be able to live such a lavish lifestyle that they now do. No one should be allowed to consume more than, let's say, $100,000 a year. Imagine that we had a law enacted like that, and that it was really possible to enforce such a law, and it would remain, it was expected to remain on the books and be enforced indefinitely. Okay, now, let's suppose we have an individual who's really very, very wealthy. He has accumulated wealth, let's imagine, of $1 billion. At what rate of return on capital would you need to secure, or how much capital, how much accumulated wealth would you need to secure an income of just $100,000 a year? Do you need $1 billion? Okay, probably close to $1 million would do it. If the rate of return were only 5%, then $2 million would do it. Okay, let's even say the rate of return were 2%. Then, okay, you'd need $10 million, you'd need $5 million, that 2%, to give you $100,000 a year. And let's assume, maybe you're afraid you might lose some of the capital you have, so you'd like $10 million to guarantee that you'll always be able to earn $100,000 a year in interest that the government will allow you to consume. All right, what would be the value to you of the remaining $990 million of your billion-dollar fortune if there was no way that you could ever possibly touch it for consumption, nor could your heirs? It would have no value, right? So I think this demonstrates the point that we value savings, at least in the name of their potential for our ability to consume. Now, in recent decades, the savings rate of the United States has declined. It's much lower than that of many other countries. You'll find that those countries which are very rapidly advancing, such as in Southeast Asia and some of the portions of mainland China, and before that in Japan and South Korea, they all had very, very high savings rates. And saving is the foundation of capital accumulation, which in turn is the foundation of economic progress. So, if we persist in saving minimally relative to others, our international position will be undermined. And if we save sufficiently little, not only our relative position, but our absolute position. Every year, whatever capital equipment we have, all the factories, the machinery, the supplies of inventories and so forth, all of these things are continually getting used up in the process of production itself. And the extent to which we produce such goods, including even their replacement, depends on saving. And if we save inadequately, it's possible that we wouldn't even produce enough fully to replace. As of now, we're producing a little bit more than is required just to replace. So we're advancing, But if we carry further the trend we've been on, we won't even be able to replace. And that puts an economy into a downward spiral. So to answer your question, if we persist in a low savings rate, we will certainly not retain economic leadership in the world, and very possibly not even our own present standard of living. And these observations have relevance to the developing debate over Social Security, which is increasingly in the news and which I wanted to make it a point at some place to address. It seems that one of the main issues being left out of the discussion is the effect of Social Security, the Social Security system, on savings. We hear a lot about proposals to privatize Social Security and what the cost of that might be. And the argument against, in favor of that change is that people would be able to earn a higher rate of return by making their own investments in the stock market or bond market, which I'm sure is a legitimate argument. But no one seems to be talking about the effect of the system that's existed for many years on savings. See, just think, when people are paying money into the Social Security system, how are many, if not most of them, regarding their payments in terms of making a provision for their future? They think they're providing for the future. They think they're saving for the future, and they have some kind of nest egg. All right, but what has the government been doing with all of the Social Security taxes that it takes in over and above what it's paying out? It's been spending. It's been spending the whole proceeds, actually. You see, if you were genuinely saving, imagine we had an annuity company. And here's an annuity company. They're selling annuity policies, and they start selling them mainly to people not yet close to retirement. So they're selling them to people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and so on. And suppose there were a private annuity company that was taking the annuity payments and using it to finance the executives' vacations in the Bahamas or whatever, or build their houses. Where would these people end up?
Jail.
They'd go to jail whenever they were found out. Well, now, the Social Security system, from its very beginning, it started collecting Social Security taxes. And from the very beginning, the taxes were expended as a regular part of government spending. Now, the Social Security fund, to the extent that they were taking in more than they were currently spending, the excess of what the Social Security system took in above what it paid out, that was put into U.S. government bonds. And people thought, oh, well, that's really a good, solid investment. Okay, but now, what happens when the day comes that the payments to recipients exceed the current payroll taxes? What happens to these accumulated bonds?
Yeah? Cashed out.
They have to be sold, right? Now, how would that differ if the government had never put the money into bonds? They just took in whatever they're taking in, and it's all spent, and there's no claim made that the excess of what's taken in from payroll taxes over what's paid out to recipients, there's no claim that that's put in bonds. It's just spent. I mean, it is just spent, but we add bonds in the process, and we put the bonds in the Social Security Trust Fund. What would happen when the day came that Social Security had to pay out more than it was then taking in?
Wouldn't be there.
Well, would there be anything less there than there is now?
No.
See, today we have Treasury bonds in the possession of the Social Security Trust Fund. And when they have to pay out more than they take in, what will they have to do with these bonds? They'll have to be sold, and someone has to buy them, right? How does that differ from the government waiting till that time and issuing brand new bonds and itself selling the bonds and giving the proceeds to pay Social Security?
Isn't it no different?
There is no difference.
It's bringing up more money.
There's no difference. There's no difference This idea that there's some investment, that the real government borrowing has not yet taken place. The real issue of treasury bonds to support Social Security has not yet taken place. The government collected the money, it spent it. It wouldn't have mattered if it didn't issue any bonds. When the time comes that they have to sell the bonds, then the public needs to absorb the bonds. It wouldn't matter if those securities didn't previously exist and the government issued them in the future when it was selling the bonds to the public. The point is that when the payroll taxes fail to exceed the current payments, when the current payments come to exceed the payroll taxes, that's when the government first really has to go into debt to pay for Social Security. Up to now, they've spent all of the proceeds. They have an obligation to Social Security, but there is no genuine investment. They'll have to get the money from the public at the time. Okay, but just one last observation in connection with this. Suppose we hadn't had Social Security and people wanted to make provision for their future. What would they have had to do? They would have had to save. Now, some people might not have saved, but many would. And then what would have happened to their savings if you had private savings vehicles of one form or another? Where would the savings be?
In their bank.
Well, many of them would be in banks. And when people bought the bonds and stocks, what would the sellers of the bonds and stocks have been doing with the money?
Spending it
on what? On their personal. They'd have been investing it. They'd have been buying factories, machinery, expanding their raw material inventory, whatever. It would have been invested. There would have been physical assets in the economy. And then when people reached old age and needed the money, what would be supporting them is their own previously accumulated savings and the income earned on it. That would be the source of their support. And the economy would have had the benefit of their savings. Now, the way things have stood is the government collects the money, but the government is not investing it. It's spending it as part of the regular budget. So the result is that a substantial part of savings that people think of as being savings have been diverted into the government's consumption for many, many years. And this is one of the significant reasons that we have such a low savings rate. See, if we didn't have Social Security and people were saving even a substantial fraction of what is now presently going into Social Security, that fraction at least would be contributing to the positive accumulation of wealth in the economy, while the Social Security payments are not. That's a very significant difference, and that's one of the reasons why we have the low savings rate that we do. So, I'm glad you raised the question, and I am glad to have had this opportunity to make some observations about a matter of current importance. Okay, well, returning to the major proposition, why we have a limitless need and desire for wealth, it ultimately is the fact that there's no limit to our range of knowledge and awareness, hence action and experience, and hence wealth as the means of acting and experiencing. And our desire for wealth always outstrips our ability to produce it. You can see why in a closely related basis. Just think, what do you need to be able to form a desire for wealth? What do you need to be able to desire a more luxurious car or a mansion or a beautiful swimming pool? Is this something really hard? Do you have to struggle some days? Boy, I can't figure out what I can do with the money I have. It's really a struggle. Is that hard?
No, it comes quite naturally.
It comes very, very easily.
You have to have the ability to, purchase the next best
thing. Well, I'm asking, what
you
is,
have to
what,
have the ability to purchase it. Pardon me? You don't have to have the ability to purchase it.
I'm just saying, what do you need to form a desire? To form a desire, all you really need to do is have an active imagination. We have a lot of knowledge already, and we've seen all sorts of things. We've been to movies where we've seen really beautiful things. We've probably passed many beautiful things personally. You know all kinds of things you'd like to have. So to desire wealth is one of the easiest things in the world. It's just an act of imagination. But what is required actually to produce the wealth? Pardon me?
Labor.
Physically, the foundation of all wealth, the physical foundation that human beings contribute is labor. And just think, what limits the range of our desires is merely the power of our imagination. What is it that limits our capacity to perform labor that's needed to produce, if not the things we exactly desire, the equivalent of what would be required to exchange for such things?
We only work so much in a day.
Yeah, it's our power, the power of our arms, essentially. And which do you think has a greater ability, a greater range of what it can accomplish or take in? Which is greater, the extent of our imagination or the power of our arms?
Imagination.
The imagination, without question. Even if we're aided by the most modern tools and machinery, the ability to accomplish physical results is far less than our ability to think of results. In imagination, you can jump thousands of miles, have wondrous, fanciful things you'd like to have, but actually to bring about results is a much, much more difficult order. The one is mental, the desires are mental, the actual production is physical, and the range of the mental far surpasses that of the physical. Now, it's on this basis that scarcity is a permanent phenomenon, with scarcity being understood here simply as the extent to which our need and desire for wealth surpasses our ability to produce it. We have a desire for wealth that always vastly surpasses our ability to produce it. And to that extent, there is always scarcity. We never have enough wealth to satisfy all of our desires for wealth. Now, there's a different sense in which scarcity is used. Scarcity is often used to imply a lack of urgently needed supplies, to connote perhaps such a thing as a famine. I think that's part of many people's idea of scarcity, at least very, very often. Just be aware there are these two distinct senses of scarcity. One means that no matter how actually abundant wealth may be, it's still scarce. In this sense, Bill Gates recently was estimated to be worth $43 billion, and whatever that would buy. Does Bill Gates have enough wealth from his point of view?
No.
No. So $43 billion is not yet enough, which means that wealth is scarce even for Bill Gates. He can think of things that would require $143 billion or more than that. So wealth, in this sense, is always scarce, meaning no matter how abundant it may be, we can have needs and desires for even more. Then there's this other meaning of scarcity, connoting a lack of urgently needed supplies. Like there's scarcity of shelter in the areas devastated by the tsunami. They have a scarcity of food, connoting that many of those people are hungry. Well, so bear in mind the existence of these two very different meanings, and I just want to point out that scarcity in the sense of a superabundance of desire, no matter how great the actual wealth may be, it's never enough because we desire still more. That scarcity in that sense operates as our protector from scarcity in the sense of a lack of urgently needed supplies. It operates as our protector against scarcity in the sense of a lack of urgently needed supplies. Now, just consider, why was the devastation in many of these areas as great as it was? Do you think there would have been as much devastation if we had had the same tsunami coming up against the coast of California?
No.
I don't think nearly as much. It might have been comparable down below the border, but not in any part of the United States. Now, why not?
Because the quality of our structures.
Our structures are so much more soundly built.
Our streets,
our roads, our means of communication, warning system. Now, what underlies all of this is that we're much richer. We have a much greater supply of wealth. But now, suppose we had had suppose that we hadn't viewed wealth as insufficient. Suppose when we were much, much poorer, we had decided, well, that's enough. We don't need any more. We could have stopped at a level comparable to where people have stopped in the countries destroyed. Now, it's not that people want to stop at that level, but they can have a government, they can have a culture, which puts many, many obstacles in their way of going any further. And if, for whatever reason, they do stop at a primitive level of wealth, then they suffer radically more from nature. If they have a desire so that when they reach the point of having just that little, they're not satisfied, they want to go further, they want to have better housing, stronger housing, better means of communication and transportation, then the fact that it wasn't sufficient where they were at, that they needed to go further, that is what operates to protect them from scarcity in the sense of a lack of urgently needed supplies. And when I refer to the transformation of the nature of scarcity under point two, I mean simply to stress that in a capitalist economy, a market economy, scarcity refers not to the lack of urgently needed supplies, but to the fact that no matter how much we have, we want still more. Now, yes, Ms. Haley.
Do you think that a fear of the scarcity, like the famine, drives people to desire more wealth? I mean, it's like these two can also, the one can drive, it's never enough, can drive you to desire to do better so that you don't come under the famine.
Well, that can happen too. Yeah. I mean, that can always be a consideration.
Certainly, like people that grew up in the Depression are more driven to save and to avoid scarcity because they've felt it before.
Yeah, and I think people who accumulate a certain amount of wealth, let's say you've accumulated amount of wealth so that it's possible to live on it, on what you've accumulated for the rest of your life, I think people will regard most of their wealth as needed for living in the future and protecting them against any kind of deprivation or a diminution in their standard of living as the years go by. Let me turn to this point, the scarcity of labor and its ineradicability, and I think you had a question on that, someone over here.
I kind of did, but I'll see if you cover it.
Okay. Now, just think, what is always physically necessary to the production of any form of wealth? What is the one element that is always needed?
Labor.
Human labor is the essential prerequisite for the production of all wealth. Labor produces the materials. It's don't think that there's a dual scarcity. We need the labor and the materials. In a given time, for a short time, you might be limited for lack of a material or lack of a piece of equipment or whatever. But how can we get more material of virtually any kind or more equipment?
Buy it.
Pardon me?
Buy it.
Well, physically.
You have to produce it.
We have to apply labor.
Dig it out of the earth.
Pardon me?
Dig it out of the earth.
Well, you get material by digging it out of the earth.
And you have to produce it.
We're producing it that way. We get more material in the form of fiber by growing it. We can increase the supply of any material by applying more labor to nature. And we can increase the supply of equipment by applying labor to material. And with the aid of already existing equipment. So lack of materials is never a fundamental. and this is true of practically everything, just think, do we get every last grain of output out of every acre of land?
No.
No. What could we always do, at least in our conditions, to get more output from the same land or any given piece of land?
Technology.
In the existing state of technology. In the existing state of technology and being as already being as efficient as we can, do we cultivate every acre to its utmost intensivity?
No.
No. You can always apply additional labor to the same land. Your output will diminish relative to the additional input. You'll have diminishing returns, but we could get more. We could get more petroleum from the existing oil fields. You know, normally, they only extract, I think, one-third of the physical amount of petroleum that's down in the ground. That's relatively easy to get out because you're working with various natural forces of pressure. So the first third of what's down there comes out relatively easily. You can then get a third one-sixth, bring it up to a half, but that third one-sixth is typically substantially more difficult to get at. You have to start lighting underground fires, perhaps, or flood the field, or pump chemicals down. But you can do it, but it's more difficult. And it would be still more difficult to go beyond that third one-sixth. And then, in practically every case, there are sources of supply that are known about and geologically proven, but which we don't work. There's a lot of land that potentially we could grow crops on, but we leave in the form of desert. If you've driven to Las Vegas, once you get close to Barstow, it's pretty desolate. Is that because it's impossible to do anything with that land? What would happen if we piped in enough fresh water? Maybe we had to add various chemicals to the soil. You could make that a very flourishing area. If we ever needed to, we could. But we don't do it because we already have a great abundance of naturally better land where we don't have to go to all of that additional effort and expense. And we don't need that extra output, so we don't do it, but it's there. And the same is true with mineral deposits. We don't exhaust all sources of mineral deposits that we know about. We exhaust only the most productive. And those that are insufficiently productive, we leave alone. But the point is, we could have more of any mineral if we wanted it at any given, within a very short time. So the wider point is that what's limiting the production of more wealth, which we want without limit, is always human labor. And this, I think, implies that human labor is fundamentally scarce. Labor is the fundamental scarce element in production. There's no limit to our need and desire for goods and services. The performance of labor is the key to getting more goods and services. And just think how this applies in the circumstances of every given individual. How much of an income would you be capable of living up to if only you could earn it?
Unlimited.
Virtually unlimited. Do you think without any difficulty you could live up to an income five times what you now earn?
Yes.
Okay. How many hours a week would you have to work at your present hourly rate of pay to earn such an income?
Five times.
But if you're already working 40 hours... It's only 168 hours in the week, but you could spend an income that would require 200 hours of your labor to perform. So your desire for the income, for the products of such labor, far exceeds your capacity to perform the labor. You'll be hospitalized by the time you get up to 80 hours a week. So you have an implicit desire for the products of 200 hours, but you're limited in your ability to work to on the order of 80. And you really don't want to work 80. You prefer to work 40, have less wealth than you otherwise might. What you really want is to have five times the wealth and get it in 20 hours. What do we have to do? What do we have to do to be able to get more and more output, more and more real income, without having to perform more and more labor, and in fact, even to perform less?
What?
Sit in your class.
We have to earn a higher wage.
Well, we have to be more productive. We have to become. We have to employ our labor more and more efficiently, so that we can produce more output per unit of labor. And this is why, you see, it's the fact that labor is scarce that we want so much more, but what we can have is always limited by our ability to work. That's why we have to strive as best we can to make each unit of labor more and more efficient, to raise its productivity, to raise its productivity. And it's from this point of view that labor is always scarce. And I refer in point three to the scarcity of labor and its ineradicability, the ineradicability of the scarcity. More people available to work does not reduce the scarcity of labor. Why not?
They each want more.
Because they come with their own quota of needs and desires that far surpasses their ability to produce. So as we add more people, we're still adding more needs and desires in excess of the labor that can be performed. Now, as we make labor more productive, even as we make labor more productive, the need and desire for its products rises. Because these same fundamental processes that enable us to become more productive open up whole new areas of consumption. To take a gross example, when the electric motor was discovered, well, the electric motor radically increased our ability to get results with the same arms and legs. But we didn't use the electric motor to sate our desire for things like candles and lanterns. The electric motor was accompanied by all sorts of totally new, different consumers' goods. All of the electrical appliances, electronics, everything that in any way depends on electricity. So the same process that enlarges our capabilities enlarges the range of things that we recognize as being desirable, the range of possibilities. Enlarge our capabilities, and we see that many more possibilities. And to take an extreme example, if we ever achieved an economy so productive that we could produce things like automobiles and other such goods to the point of sating our desire for them, so that the average person could have a variety of automobiles for different purposes. You'd have a sports utility vehicle for one occasion, a sleek two-seater sports car for another, a sedan for a third, change them to go with different outfits. If we ever had such an incredible productive ability, the ability to produce on that scale would require radical advances in methods of production and technology, that might open up such things as making it feasible for people to think about having a house on the moon or God knows what. Again, the possibilities would widen as the capabilities. So labor remains permanently scarce. And then this, of course, raises an immediate question that comes up in point four. Why then does unemployment exist? Why do we have periods of unemployment? And there have been periods of truly mass unemployment that have persisted for considerable times. And that will be the issue that we'll address 2 weeks from tonight when we discuss unemployment. And we'll see there is an explanation for mass unemployment, and it is perfectly consistent, logically compatible with the underlying fundamental scarcity of labor. We'll see that there is no contradiction. Okay, well, let me pause here and see if there are any... I'm skipping over the subject of time preference for reasons of time. Let me see if anyone has any question on any of this that we've been discussing up to now. Okay, well... I say here, as I already have, that according to productionism, the fundamental problem of economic life is how to expand the ability to produce in the face of a limitless need and desire for wealth. And let me immediately proceed to what I refer to as the productionist aggregate demand curve. and I point out it's based on the quantity theory of money. And let's bring that up right away. All right, here we are. This is the productionist aggregate demand curve. And it's drawn in a way that is consistent with the quantity theory of money that we spent a lot of time on in the last few weeks. What is the central proposition of the quantity theory of money? What does it claim? What's the essential point it claims? What does the quantity theory of money say?
The more money you have in circulation. The amount of money that you have in circulation is, let me rephrase that. The amount of spending depends on how much money you have in circulation.
Yeah, the amount of money that is spent, depends on the amount of money that exists. The amount of spending depends on the quantity of money that exists. Now, suppose we had just some definite quantity of money in existence. Imagine that that was it for an indefinite period of time, many, many years. There's just such and so much quantity of money. What should we expect for that to imply about the volume of spending that went on in such an economy? If we had an unchanged quantity of money, what would that imply about the volume of total spending in an economy? It would be constant. We'd have an unchanged volume of spending. Well, that's what this curve represents. This curve is drawn showing that there is an unchanged total volume of expenditure. You might imagine that this expenditure is $10 trillion. It could be any definite amount, just so long as it's unchanged. There's some definite amount of spending. And we'll assume that the quantity of money is going to remain the same, so that the total spending will remain the same. That's what's implied by the quantity theory of money. If we have the same quantity of money, we should expect the same total spending. Now, the question is, how much can the same total spending buy? And here we are. We have the price level on the vertical axis. We have output on the horizontal axis. And this is the given amount of spending. It's shown by this curve. At a price level of 1, at some initial price level, 1.0 or 100%, this given volume of expenditure is capable of buying just this volume of output, the output 1.0. Now, let's reduce it to the simplest possible terms. Suppose we were looking at a given expenditure for one item. $1 is being spent to purchase eggs. And all we're going to spend, or all some given individual is going to spend in buying eggs, is $1. Okay, if the price of an egg is $1, how many eggs can he buy for his dollar?
$1.
Just one. Okay, so here we are. For that case, we have $1 at a price level of 1 buys one egg. But now, how much can that same $1 buy if the price level, instead of being $1 per egg, is 50 cents per egg? Then now 2 eggs. How much can that same $1 buy if the price level for eggs is 25 cents rather than 50 cents or a dollar? 4. And if the price of an egg were 12 and a half cents?
8.
And if it were 10 cents? 10. And if it were a penny?
100.
Okay, there's no limit. A tenth of a cent, you could buy 1,000. Now, of course, we don't want an indefinite supply of eggs. Now you have to make the transition to an overview of the entire economy. While there is a limit to how many eggs we want, is there a limit to how much wealth in total that we want, allowing for all kinds of upgrades, transition to different kinds of luxury goods, the ability to achieve things you otherwise wouldn't even dream of achieving. We have in the whole economy, our ability to spend is limited. It's not limited to $1, as in this egg case, but let's say it's limited to $10 trillion. It's limited to $10 trillion because we have a certain quantity of money. That quantity of money supports an annual spending of $10 trillion to buy consumers' goods. And that $10 trillion is indicated by this curve. This curve indicates the total spending in the economy. It's total spending for consumers' goods. You can take GDP as an approximation. And the key issue is how much of a physical output is this same expenditure potentially capable of buying? How much is $10 trillion potentially capable of buying? Is it limited to just what it can buy today?
No.
Would it be conceivable that $10 trillion 50 years from now could buy 5 or 10 times as much as what it buys today, if by that time we could produce 5 or 10 times as much? Okay, so the same spending could buy an indefinitely large physical quantity of wealth. What would have to happen to make that possible? We'd have to have prices reduced. If prices are sufficiently low, we could buy 10 times the output we now buy. If here we are, this is where we are today. Today's price level is 1. Today's output is 1. The same spending of today could buy 10 times as much as it does today, but provided what were true. If the price level were a tenth. If the price level were a tenth. So what's illustrated here is there is no limit even to what an unchanged quantity of money, an unchanged volume of spending is capable of buying. There's no fixed limit. What sets the limit at any given moment?
Supply.
Well, supply is a correct answer, but there's one other element required that connects the supply, that enables the expenditure to buy the supply, whatever it may be.
The demand of it.
Well, here's the demand. The demand is the expenditure. The desire is limitless. What is required for the same expenditure to buy twice as much? Yes?
The price level.
The price level. The price level has to be half as great, or whatever it may be. The same expenditure can buy more without limit if more is produced. The only requirement is that the price level decline in inverse proportion to the increase in supply. The same expenditure can buy twice the supply if the price level halves. It can buy 4 times the supply if the price level quarters, and so on. Now, we'll see next week, we'll get into Say's law, and we'll develop the proposition that what's determining our ability to buy, what's determining real demand is just production and supply. It's production and supply that's determining our actual ability to make purchases.
Okay,
yes?
Can you repeat again? You said price must decrease to buy more.
We're
talking about
the... Prices must decline for the same expenditure to buy the larger supply produced. The same expenditure can buy any supply provided prices are free to adjust. Now, this is the productionist aggregate demand curve. It's saying that even if we had an unchanged quantity of money, an unchanged ability to spend money, an unchanged total volume of spending, there's no limit to our capacity to buy goods and services. No matter how much is produced, all that would be required is for prices to be correspondingly lower. For when production doubles, for prices to halve, for when it increases 4 times, for prices to quarter, and so on. And then there's no limit to how much goods and services we can absorb. That's the productionist view. And it's based on 2 things. One is the quantity theory of money. The quantity theory of money says the amount of money spent depends on the amount of money that exists. So if we have a given amount of money in existence, that would imply a given amount of spending. And every point on this curve is showing the same amount of spending. Just notice, why is that the case? Why is it that every point on this curve reflects the same amount of spending?
Because
it implies the same amount of spending. And suppose you were to draw a rectangle at any point from the vertical axis over to the curve and then down. What would be the area of this rectangle bounded by the point on the curve, 1.0 on the vertical axis, and 1.0 on the horizontal axis? What would be the area of that rectangle? Well, I'm asking a direct question. What would be the area of this rectangle bounded by 1 on the vertical axis, coming over to the curve at that point, and coming straight down from that point to 1 on the horizontal? Yes, 1 times 1. The area would be 1, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, what is the area under the curve if the price is 0.5 and the quantity is 2? We have a wider, shorter rectangle. It's still 1. 0.5 times 2 is still 1. And 0.25 times 4, that's still 1. And 0.10 times 10, that's still 1. Well, the 1 refers to whatever the amount of money being spent is, it's unchanged. So this is an unchanged expenditure of money. The unchanged expenditure of money is what you'd expect from the quantity theory of money operating with an unchanged supply of money, an unchanged actual quantity of money. Now, the other element that's present that operates to assure that the volume of spending will remain the same, won't shrink, is that there's no limit to our need and desire for wealth. So if we can obtain twice the wealth or four times the wealth, we're going to want it. We'll be willing to spend the same total amount of money if prices are lower. We'll be willing to buy the extra output. Now, it doesn't mean we're eager to buy more and more units of the same kind. We're not going to be eating multiple quantities of hamburgers or cheeseburgers. But in what form would we be willing to take a larger supply of food? Pardon me? Better quality food. So if you are substituting sirloin steak for hamburgers, that doesn't mean a larger quantity of calories or a larger physical volume that you have to digest, but it is a larger production. If you're substituting champagne and caviar for some things. And then you don't have to keep on eating more and more food. Suppose you've optimized your diet, you have the most enjoyable diet you can imagine, consistent with your with science and technology. Can you still use additional wealth? Do you have the house of your dreams? If you have the house of your dreams, your hunting lodge in Maine, an apartment on the Avenue Foch in Paris or some equivalent, then there are still all kinds of things that can be wanted.
Servants to clean it.
You want servants to clean it. But there is no limit. So what the productionist aggregate demand curve is saying is that there is no limit to how much output the economy is able and willing to absorb. All that would have to happen here is that we would have lower prices. Now let me make one modification in this. We don't really need the assumption of a fixed quantity of money. We don't need the assumption of a fixed quantity of money, but that's always a very good starting point. It's a very helpful way to begin things. Suppose we had rising production. Suppose we have scientific and technological progress. There's saving and capital accumulation going on, so we have more and better plant and equipment that's embodying the improvements in science and technology. We have new types of materials being produced on the same foundation. Now, if we have a general, wide-ranging increase in the ability to produce, what do you think that this would imply about our ability to extract minerals, including the different metals? Pardon me?
If we have, as far as resources, getting resources to build these new machines?
Well, if we have the ability to produce more and better machines of various types and materials, what should we expect to be the effect on our ability to extract minerals?
Machines.
more effective mining.
That should increase. We should be able to mine more of practically everything. And that would include the precious metals, too. And so if we had a gold standard, what would be happening to the supply of money? It would be increasing modestly. Now, if the quantity of money is governing the volume of spending, what effect would that have on the way we would have to draw the demand curve? Would there be just one demand curve? The demand curve would be shifting. We'd have a higher and higher demand curve. It would be shifting up and to the right. So realistically, if we had five times the level of production in 50 or 100 years, we would not expect to have just the same quantity of money and volume of spending we now do. There'd be some significant increase, but it very well might not be as great an increase. So we should allow for there being an increase, but that's not really essential. Everything would work even if there were no such increase. Even if there were no increase, which in fact there would be, but even if there were none, the same expenditure would be capable of buying all that we could produce additionally in the way of ordinary goods and services. Yes, Ms. Ramos.
So then essentially, although you'd have more money in the money supply, it would still seem unchanged because prices would be relative to the amount, inflation, because prices, everything would go up, right?
And if we had more money in spending, would that mean the prices would go up? The prices would be higher to the degree we have more money in spending compared to what they would be if we didn't have that money in spending. That doesn't mean they would be higher than they are at any given time in the past.
Well, but wouldn't it shift? You said it would shift the curve, right?
Yeah, right. It would shift the curve. Now, just think of it this way, and I think I asked such a question. Maybe I asked the opposite question. Suppose over a period of years, maybe 50 years, our physical ability to produce would increase over some period of time, our physical ability to produce would increase by a factor of 10. But over the same period of time, the quantity of money and volume of spending would increase by a factor of 5. How would prices look at the end of that process? Would they be higher than they were at the beginning? We have 5 times the money in spending, but 10 times the production and supply. Prices would be half, right? They'd be half. They would have fallen in half. 5 divided by 10 is half. Now, suppose we had the 10-fold increase in production and supply and no increase in money and spending. Well,
prices
wouldn't be increased, but what would enable the same money in spending to buy 10 times the output? You have it right here. Prices would have to fall to a tenth. Now, if they fall to a half instead of a tenth, that's 5/10 instead of 1/10, the increase in money and spending is making prices 5 times higher than they otherwise would have been, but not 5 times higher than they were. They're half of what they were. So the increase in money and spending over the gold standard, it makes prices higher than they'd be if there were no increase in money and spending, but prices would likely still be lower than they were at the beginning. At the end of the 19th century, prices were half of what they were at the end of the 18th century. Over the 19th century, there was a substantial increase in money and spending, but an increase in production and supply twice as large. Okay, you grasp the productionist aggregate demand curve and realize that it's capable of supporting any volume of spending. Now, let's go back to the supplement. So here, hopefully this will be meaningful. The demand curve is asymptotic. Asymptotic just means it never will cross either axis. It gets closer and closer to the axes without ever crossing them. You can see it will never cross the axis. If we had 100 times the output, prices would be 1/100, but they'd still never be below the axis. All right, now we want to turn to the opposite view, consumptionism. And this is a diametrically opposite view. And the way I describe it is the belief, this is what consumptionism is, it's a belief in a fixed aggregate demand in real terms, a fixed aggregate demand in real terms. This is the notion that instead of people being willing, if prices are sufficiently low, to buy an unlimited output of goods and services, they're only willing to buy just such and so much, and no more. They allegedly want just some definite, fixed, delimited amount, and that's it. And if we produce more than that, they just won't buy it. Well, that's what they think is the situation, that demand is fixed in terms of the amount of things that people will buy, and that the fundamental problem of economic life, instead of being expanding our production of wealth, instead of that, it's how to expand the need and desire for wealth in the face of an ability to produce that exceeds that need and desire. The consumptionists claim that we need and desire just so much, and the problem is we are able to produce more than that, or very soon will be. And let me immediately present that view in a diagram. And here we are, we have it. I call it the consumptionist view of the economic world. Here's the price level, here's output. But according to the consumptionists, demand, instead of having this asymptotic curvature, demand is a vertical line indicating that the people want just such and so much. And it doesn't matter how low prices go. If prices are up here initially, they want this quantity. If prices are down here, they don't want any more. If prices get all the way to zero, they still just want quantity A, and that's it. Allegedly, people need and desire just some fixed, delimited amount. And our problem is that we have the ability to produce more than that. We have the ability to produce B. So the aggregate supply, SS, is out here, substantially to the right of aggregate demand, DD. And this is how the consumptionist sees the world. He thinks that either we're already in this situation or are about to get put into that situation. Now let me ask if you've ever heard any explanation of depressions taking place in history on the basis of an idea that is represented by this diagram. What is a common explanation of depressions? It's a long word consisting, it's made out of two lesser words, one of which is production.
Overproduction.
Have any of you ever read anywhere that this or that depression was the result of overproduction? How much history have you been reading? Well, this is a very common belief that depressions are caused by overproduction. That's known as the overproduction doctrine. Now, let's see how this connects with ideas that I'm confident you'll have greater familiarity with. We'll just put another diagram together with this. Yes, Mr. Milan.
Well, what about the depression in 1929?
Yeah.
That was from overproduction.
Well, there are many people who think that it was, yeah.
So you're saying people think it is, but it's really not.
That's right. Because as I say, I subscribe to productionism, so we can't have too much production. Just think of the implications of thinking that depressions are the result of overproduction. In a depression, are people poorer or richer?
Poorer.
They're poorer. Now, the overproduction doctrine is claiming that here we are, we're in a depression, and people can't afford to buy food. And why can't they buy food? Well, we produce too much food. Why can't they afford to live in a nice apartment? We've built too many houses. Why can't they afford clothing? We produce too much clothing. It's a mind-boggling contradiction to claim that poverty is caused by wealth. That's what it comes down to.
If you overproduce, then that should lead to decreased pricing. Number one, you have to overproduce, you got to have more labor. By having more labor, you have more employment, people are making more money, so you still have more production, so they're lowering prices. So.
Yeah, but you see, the consumptionists claim that people need and desire just so much. And as we'll see in a moment, let's even get into it. It's this doctrine, this framework up here, that underlies the belief that machinery causes unemployment. And certainly many people believe that, don't they? Isn't it a widely held belief even today that machinery causes unemployment, or automation causes unemployment? Now, how can anyone believe that? Well, let's start with the idea. Let's assume for the moment that this were the demand, that it is fixed. And let's imagine that initially the total supply curve, this aggregate supply curve, initially were back here, hidden underneath the aggregate demand curve. So initially we have the aggregate demand and the aggregate supply, they're in perfect balance, no problem yet. And down here we have a different diagram that's relating output to the quantity of labor employed. There's a fancy name for this kind of relationship. It's not my name. You'll find it throughout the economics literature. It's called a production function, a production function. Here we're showing employment on the vertical axis. As we go up, that signifies more people being employed. And as we come out, we're showing output. And this, either of these lines, is a production function, the relationship between the input of labor and the output of goods and services. And let's say this is our initial production function. Here's where we are to begin with. And this point F stands for full employment. When F of labor is employed, that means that everyone able and willing to work is working. And when they're working, how much do they produce on this production function?
A.
They produce the output A. So you come across from F to this line. And if you go down, you get the output A. And now as we go up to this diagram, we have an output of A, and that, happily, is the volume of output that the public wants to buy. So we can continue to have full employment indefinitely. That's our initial starting point. But now what happens when these devilish scientists and businessmen start introducing improved methods of production? They insist on being more efficient. And when they get to be more efficient, what that will do is give us a new production function. How much will any given amount of labor produce on this lower, more efficient production function? How much does how much does full employment labor produce?
S.
It produces B, which generates S. So notice, at full employment now, we're producing this larger supply. We're producing S. But the market still only wants A, allegedly. So here we are, if we have full employment using the machinery, we're allegedly producing the output B, while the market only wants the old, smaller output A. Now, how long will businessmen go on producing B if the customers are only willing to buy A? Not very long. So what allegedly is going to happen to production? Our production will be cut back again to A, but when we cut production back to A on this, we're now on this more efficient production function. A no longer represents full employment. We don't need full employment to give us A. How much employment do we need to result in A on this lower, more efficient production function?
G.
We now only need G of labor. G of labor produces that output A. And what is the alleged result? There's unemployment now equal to FG. It's argued that the public wants just such and so much output. To the extent that machines can account for part of that output, what's implied about the output left for people to produce?
It goes away.
The argument is, look at it this way. It's claimed that we need and desire just such and so much wealth, indicated by the point A. Now, that implies a need for just such and so much labor. Initially, that amount of labor is F. That's the labor required for people. But now machinery comes into play, and the machines are doing work that people used to do. We now only need G of people, and the machines do the rest. G of people accomplishes this much by the old method. Machinery enables fewer people to do the same. Machinery, on this basis, is allegedly taking work away from people. It's depriving FG of people of work. It's thought the total work to be done in the world is the work required to produce this output A. And to the extent that machines now contribute to the production of that output, what allegedly is the case with regard to work for people to do?
Less work.
There's less work. It's thought there's only so much work in the world, or as people who are on this mentality would describe it, so much work to be done. And to the extent that the machines are doing the work, there's less work for people to do. That's how they think of it. And it's on this basis that they think machinery is causing unemployment. But the underlying idea is there's need for just such and so much output. And to the extent that we can produce that same output with less human labor, because machines enable each unit to accomplish more, there's that much less need for the labor of people. Machinery is allegedly destroying work. That's how it's viewed. Yes?
I know that these are all aggregates, but
yeah.
Would this model make more sense in explaining unemployment and depression if it's saying that there's maybe overproduction of the wrong sort of things?
Oh, yeah. There can be an overproduction of some things. This would be a relative overproduction.
Like you get more efficiency from machinery, you overproduce, some technology piece, and then you saturate the market, and then you have to lay off people because no one will buy your products.
Yeah. Now, this could certainly occur in individual industries. And let's take the most extreme possible case. Let's say table salt. Now, table salt is an individual good, the demand for which may actually be perfectly vertical. It's this one individual good. I don't think there's anyone waiting for the price of table salt to fall before he puts more salt on his food. So,
got the only thing you can afford is the grocery store.
Pardon me?
It's the only thing you can afford.
Oh, maybe so. Okay. All right, now. Let's imagine that we had some major labor-saving improvements taking place just in the production of table salt. And the net result was that the total labor required to produce the average box of table salt was cut in half. That counts the labor not just to mine the salt, but to make the box, to transport it, do everything that's in connection with getting the boxes onto the into the supermarkets and on the shelves. All right, so here we are. Half the labor is now capable of producing the same quantity. Do you think we could continue to employ the same labor? If we employed the same labor, we'd certainly have an overproduction of table salt. People don't want twice the table salt. They really want just the present quantity. So what will happen to employment in the production of table salt? That will tend to be cut in half. But does that mean that machinery has caused unemployment? Because just think, while people don't want more table salt, is there anything that they do want more of?
Sure.
All kinds of things. And now, if we need only half the labor to produce the table salt, is that labor capable of producing any of the other things that people would want in additional quantity? Or taking jobs of other people who would move over into producing things that people want in additional quantity?
But could that depression be caused from that downtime from the redistribution of labor?
Well, you can have a bad situation for workers in table salt production. But notice what has happened to the amount of funds required to produce the same quantity of table salt.
It's been decreased.
You only need pretty much half the money to produce the same quantity of table salt. Where will those funds be used? Will they just be hoarded, or will they be invested in some other part of the economy? They'll be invested in some other part of the economy, and so what will be happening to demand and production elsewhere? that will increase, and so it may not be that the people who've lost their jobs in table salt experience the rise in demand, but it will occur somewhere in the economy. They'll have to look for jobs in different places, but there'll be people leaving other places to take the jobs where the demand has expanded. And then if we need only half the labor to produce table salt, sooner or later, what will happen to the price of table salt?
It's going to go down.
It's going to go down, and if you think of the implications of half the total labor, we should expect the price of table salt to go down on the order of half. Now, do the buyers of table salt have any alternative use for whatever funds they could save from the purchase of table salt?
Yep.
Certainly they do. Different people will spend it for different things, but the demand for different products, things that people couldn't quite afford before, that's going to go up. And that's where new employment opportunities in the long run will be found. So what's the net effect of all this? If we can succeed in producing table salt with half the labor, does that mean that we've now added to unemployment when you allow time for adjustment to occur? No, there'll be a change in the pattern of employment. Fewer people will produce table salt. More people will produce other kinds of goods that people couldn't previously have afforded because they were spending so much for table salt. The effect will be we'll have the same volume of employment, but a larger total of production, and to that extent, the standard of living will be somewhat higher. And that's the way machinery is always working. It's changing the pattern of employment. In a case like table salt, or even less extreme situations, you end up with fewer people employed in that industry. Or sometimes it's only a particular stage of production. Suppose we have a product that has various stages, and there's a dramatic labor-saving improvement in one of those stages. Imagine we could put much longer-lasting siding on houses. You could have siding that you'd never have to paint the house. This would be very bad for house painters, right? But what would it be doing to the effective cost of buying and owning a home? It would decrease it. And what do you think that would do to the number of homes demanded? It would increase it. And now, if you're going to have more homes being constructed, what does that imply about the number of carpenters, plumbers, bricklayers, etc., who are required? So, you see, when you have a labor-saving improvement at one stage in the production of something, to whatever extent, by making the product cheaper, it results in some increase in quantity demanded, it will also serve to increase employment in the other stages of the production of the same product. And to the extent that we have a case where less ends up being spent on a given product, more will be spent on other products. And the most important illustration of this in economic history, I think, is the effect of all of the labor-saving improvements in agriculture. Just think, as we became able to grow more and more food with less and less labor, what did that do to the proportion of the labor force that we needed to keep in agriculture? It shrank dramatically. At one time, 9 workers out of 10 was in agriculture. Now it's on the order of 3 in 100. What effect has that had on the general standard of living?
It's increased it
hugely. Instead of people having to spend a huge fraction of their budget just on food, they now get their food for a much smaller fraction of the budget. They have a lot more funds available to spend on other things that were previously impossible. And the people who otherwise would have been still back in farming, they're producing these other things. So the result is we have the same employment, but much more output. There was a question over here. Yes, Mr. Horner.
Along those lines, those shifts, and I see how you see there's a shift in labor to different areas. From the farming standpoint, when you shift from the agricultural to the more urban when the people moved, had a migration from the farms into the city for more work.
Yeah.
There's a time period when they need a learning curve, when they need to learn how to do the manufacturing jobs. So the jobs are more, they had a different labor requirement than they had on the farm. And I'm seeing now with the outsourcing of certain jobs now to other nations, mm-hmm. isn't there a shift in the learning ability, what you need to do, the jobs that are available here in the United States? And with that shift, is there a depression or a decrease in wealth?
Okay, a couple of points. When you have some negative development in a particular industry, and at the same time, there are factors creating positive developments in other industries, that's not a general depression. A general depression is when practically all branches of industry are bad at the same time. We had that in the 1930s, that was our worst experience. When all of a sudden, every industry, or just about every industry, is faced with the declining sales revenues, profits plunging, and there's a development of mass unemployment. That's a general depression. But as I'll be at great pains to show, that is never caused by too much production. That's not the result of too much production. That's the result of a monetary financial contraction. That's the result of a reduction in the quantity of money and volume of spending, accompanied by a rise in the demand for money for holding, a drop in velocity, which has no connection with more production. More production never put us in that situation. More production can cause some people to lose their jobs for a time, but let's analyze that a bit and look at the short-run effects of improvements in production. I think we need to distinguish between three different groups of people who can be affected by improvements that make them lose their present jobs. There's unskilled workers, skilled workers, and people who lose invested fortunes. How quickly does it take to learn a new unskilled job? Very, very short. Well, that short period implies the limit of the short run. That's all, how long the short run needs to be. And in fact, today, if you look at the ability of even the poorest people to cross the country, if in no other way than by bus, in a country like the United States, the whole labor market of the country is open to everybody, or the whole unskilled labor market physically is open to everybody, in the sense that you could be there if you needed to be. And the time to get up to a comparable level of skill in a new unskilled job after you've lost an old unskilled job, that should really be minimal. Now, it doesn't mean that it's so easy to do. There are things that we have that make it a lot harder to make the switch. Could anyone think of any circumstance that operates to prevent people from being quickly reemployed at an unskilled level?
Minimum wage.
A minimum wage law. If you have an artificially high wage rate or high price of anything, what's that do to the quantity of the item demanded?
It decreases
it. And now, in a free market, if there are no interferences with prices, if the supply is temporarily exceeding the demand, what happens to the price? The price goes down, and as the price goes down, or in this case the wage, what happens to the quantity of labor or whatever it might be demanded?
Increases.
It goes up, and that goes as far as needed to have full employment. Well, to the extent that we have minimum wage legislation, and perhaps even more importantly than that, pro-union legislation, the unions are setting their kind of minimum wages for semi-skilled and skilled workers. They're setting wage rates higher up for not just for unskilled workers, but for more skilled workers. That operates to reduce the quantity of labor demanded. And where do the workers go who might have been employed at the lower wage rates, but who can't be employed because the wage rates are compelled to be higher?
Unemployed.
Either they're unemployed or they crowd into the lesser fields, requiring that wage rates there go down further than they otherwise would need to. Or if they can't go down, then people spilling over from the higher jobs, forced out of them by wage rates being too high, they displace less capable people who may then end up altogether unemployed and can't find a job. Now, if we had a free labor market, certainly unskilled workers could pretty quickly acquire comparable jobs in some other line with a very short learning period. It's a more serious problem. Suppose you're a skilled worker and you have a skill that's taken several years to learn, and now that job is made obsolete. Let's say you were a typesetter, and now we have computerized typesetting that eliminates that job. Well, how long should it take you reasonably to acquire another set of skills at a comparable level?
3 years, you said.
On the order of the same period of time, 3 years. All right, in that interval, you might have a loss. But is there anything that people could do and routinely do, and perhaps many of you are doing, in anticipation of losing your present jobs?
Get education.
Get education. Retrain in one form or another while you're still working. It's more often than not, it's possible to see the handwriting on the wall, and most people have the ability to take steps to undergo the retraining while they have their present jobs. And so they don't have to be in a state of personal depression. Their penalty is they have to come and sit in classes. So hopefully that's better. But the overall thrust of things, you see, because we make these adjustments, if we didn't want to make these adjustments or made them more difficult, what would happen to the ability to raise the productivity of labor and the standard of living?
Can you repeat that?
If we didn't make these adjustments, if we didn't require that periodically people change their jobs and learn something new, because they had gotten used to it and was comfortable to continue doing what they're doing, what would happen to the ability to raise the productivity of labor and the standard of living?
We wouldn't
be able to do it.
We would still have Pony Express.
Pardon me?
We still have Pony Express.
We could still have the Pony Express, yeah. Or not even have that, depending on when you adopted this. Okay, so that's the basic story with machinery, and at the risk of repeating what I might already have observed, if we wanted to put a number on it, how much would you estimate the rise in the productivity of labor over the last 200 years? Put any reasonable kind of number on it. 100?
About 1,000.
All right, 1,000. All right. It's certainly huge. Let's just work with 100, which is a little easier. Since 1805, the output per unit of labor, I think, has gone up on the order of 100 or even more. In 1805, if we had roughly full employment and machinery caused unemployment, if the increases in the output of a unit of labor represented a cause of unemployment, then what should be the unemployment rate today?
Enormous.
Well, if we started with 100% employment, and now it takes only 1% as much labor to produce an output equivalent to what was produced in 1805, should we have a 99% unemployment rate by now? But how do you think the unemployment rate today compares with the unemployment rate of 1805? Maybe even a little less. It's certainly not significantly higher. It's not significantly different. Here we are. We have the same ratio of employment unemployment. But what's different is we produce 100 times as much or more than that per unit of labor. And that's what allows us to have today's standard of living rather than the standard of living of 1805. And to have it while working 40 hours instead of 70 or 80 hours. And also, as a byproduct of the same process, what happened to the number of children who could survive into adulthood and the average length of life expectancy?
Increase.
Both of those greatly increased. And so what has that done to the size of our population and the absolute number of people who need to work and who are working?
Increased.
It's greatly increased. So we have vastly more people working producing radically more per unit of labor, and there's no significant change in the unemployment rate. The change is a radically higher output per capita and a radically higher standard of living. That's the actual effect of machinery. And what explains it is that the aggregate demand curve is actually like this. We've absorbed the vast increase in output. And of course, at the same time, the demand has grown, the monetary demand. It's definitely not as the consumption is projected. It's definitely not that there's a fixed delimited output demand. On this basis, what should be the unemployment rate today? 99%. And on the productionist basis, we get the unemployment rate that we actually have, no different from what it was. Okay, we're just about exactly at our break time, so why don't we take a break and come back at 5 after, and we'll go into further major applications.